that you are all here this morning. Back at the beginning of the year, when we were making plans for this year, we allocated this day as a day for elders, and we wanted to do some training and orientation, some discussion, because, as you know, elders are going to be key in working through the issues of leadership of the church, especially coming up to the session that's taking place at the beginning of October. And then, as time went on, Pastor Lou Edwards contacted me and said that he's heard this amazing presentation from Dr. Daniel Dudar from the division about the whole issue of keeping the church united in the light of the discussions that are taking place and the proposal for a vote at the GC session on whether to allow the divisions themselves to decide on this issue. And there's been for those of you who've been aware of some of the different websites, you know that the controversy is taking place in not just mild and measured tones. Some websites and some speakers are speaking in a quite inappropriate way about brothers and sisters in the church. And so, in the light of that, I felt that this was an inspired suggestion. And so I am so pleased to be able to welcome today Dr. Daniel Dudar, who was a teacher at Newbold for many years. And then for the last 5 years, 9 years, you've been at the division as the director of education there. And he's had other responsibilities with ministerial, your assistant associate minister in the ministerial department there. And so, it was lovely to welcome you to Scotland this weekend. I know those who were in Edinburgh were blessed by his ministry yesterday. And today, we are here to hear what you have been guided to present for us. And we're really looking forward to it. If you can tell us a little bit more about the plan for the day and about when discussion will take place and so on, I think people would appreciate that. So it's over to you, Dr. Daniel Dudar.
Although, as you can see, I didn't put the doctor there. Lou even mentioned in the prayer. I think on Sabbath morning, we are brothers and sisters. Okay, it's Sunday, but still. You know, when we come for the accreditation visit and leave behind a document for the school saying you are doing this and this well, we commend you for that, but we recommend that you do in the next 5 years this and that. People might ask, and who are these people that they recommend us to do something? So then we sign the papers and say, okay, I have studied also, I have got my degrees, but on Sabbath morning, come on, we are brothers and sisters, and Sunday morning as well. But anyway, so nice to be back in Crieff. I was thinking Friday, as I was driving up, the first time I was here was when Bob Rodd invited me for a Bible conference in 99. Can you believe it? And I still don't understand why and how, because I was a new lecturer at Newbold. Lou Edwards invited me for the camp meeting of North England Conference, and then I came here. I was here for the ordination of Marcel. So nice to see you. And of course, the last time I was here was 1844 and all that. So good to be here. Yes, let me start with this. Why are we talking about this? And yesterday in Edinburgh Church, there was two guys from Romania. And they asked me, so what do you think will be the outcome in July? And I said, you know, I'm not a prophet. I can't predict. But they said, but you know, the Bible is so clear. We should not follow the culture. We should follow the Bible. Yeah, definitely. Tell me how you read the Bible. So here is the problem. Ideas have a life of their own. Ideas and doctrines over the years have a tendency to develop a life of their own. No, doctrines and ideas are like a cat. In English, we say that a cat has 9 lives. Okay, it has a life of its own, and just lives its own independent life. And after a while, people do not know anymore where the idea comes from. They are just sincerely convinced that what they believe is from the Bible. They are not aware of the centuries of the development behind the idea. They just are genuinely convinced that what they believe is what the Bible teaches. Let me give you a classical example of that. You go to any Bible dictionary and look up the Lord's Day. And it will say something like this. In the Old Testament, God's people kept the Sabbath as the Lord's Day. Brackets, see Exodus 20, verse 8 to 11. However, in the New Testament, very early, the Christian church started to keep Sunday as a memorial of Christ's resurrection as the Lord's Day. Brackets, Acts 20, verse 7, 1 Corinthians 16, 2, brackets close, full stop. Now, you look up Acts 20, verse 7, and it says something like this. On the first day of the week, we met together because Paul was supposed to travel the next day, and there were many lights in the room, and he spoke too long, and Eutychus fell asleep and fell from the balcony. Okay? Now, if you go into New English Bible, now, it has nothing to do with the Seventh-day Adventist. New English Bible translation translates Saturday night as we met. You know, there were many lights in the room because Paul was supposed to travel the next day. What does Saturday night meeting say about keeping Sunday? Nothing. Because the first day of the week starts, according to biblical reckoning, Saturday night after the sunset. Similarly, if you go, so the text has nothing to do with Sunday keeping. Yet in most Bible dictionaries, it will be quoted as a proof that the early church kept Sunday. If you go to 1 Corinthians 16:2, it says, first day of the week, let each one of you put aside whatever you decided to sacrifice for poor people in Jerusalem, so that the collection is not made when I come, Paul says. And what's the meaning of that? Paul says, when the basket comes along, you know, and then you start thinking, okay, what is it that I can sacrifice for those poor Christians in Jerusalem? Your help is not going to be meaningful. So, let's do it this way, Paul says. The first day of the week, now, why first day of the week? Put aside how much you want to sacrifice. Because the first day of the week was the pay day in Roman Empire. Excuse me. Now, in those days, you did not get your salary by electronic transfer into your bank account, you know. You got it every week in cash, okay? And the first day of the week was the pay day in the Roman Empire. And Paul says, if you want to help the poor people in Jerusalem, then when you get your money, when you get your salary, think through, okay, what is it that I can do? How can I help them? What can I put aside? Budget accordingly. And then when I come, you just collect the funds, and then your help will be meaningful. Now, there are two important Greek words in that text. First day of the week, put aside perhelotu, which means by yourself. Some translations even leave out those words. Now, here's the question. Where were the believers on the first day of the week? By themselves at home. Yet, any Bible dictionary, you can look it up under the Lord's Day, will have Acts 20, verse 7, 1 Corinthians 16, 2, as the proofs that the early church kept Sunday. Why, the text clearly says they were by themselves at home. Why is it so? Because people have no idea where the idea comes from. They are just sincerely convinced that what they believe is what the Bible teaches. Now, here's the bottom line. If it works with other Christians, and that's why I gave you the example from other Christians, because it's always easier to see on someone else than in yourself, do you think the same is true for Seventh-day Adventists?
Yes.
Yeah, it works with us as well. Talmud said it so well a long time ago. We do not see the world the way it is. We see the world the way we are. What you see says more about you than about the world out there. If you take a leaf and put it under a microscope and you look at it, and a PhD in dendrology, dendrology is the science of trees, looks at it, do we see the same thing? No. I mean, we do see the same thing, yet we don't see the same thing. Why? Because what you see there is determined by the presuppositions, by the filter, by the spectacles that you have, so to say. We don't see the world the way it is. Now, here we are in Scotland, and it's to be said that Scottish common sense philosophy was a genius response to 19th century liberalism. You know, Francis Bacon, they came up with this idea that a sincere soul can see the reality and jump on it. My father is a retired pastor, and when I come and visit him, he sometimes would point out of the window and say, "Do you see that old man walking there?" No. My father is 84 and he would say, "Do you see that old man?" That's the professor from the university, from the local university. And he says, "I need to give him the great controversy book so that he can see the light." And I feel like saying, "Dad, he walks on a completely different planet than you do. His operating system is very different than yours." But you see, he still has this idea that if the sincere soul sees the truth, they will jump on it. Because in 19th century, you believe that we engage with the reality directly. Now you and I know, no. What is here influences what you see out there. I was at the conference in Jerusalem that TED organized, 2006, and Lawrence Turner from Newbold had a paper, "Reading the Book of Esther After the Holocaust." And just listening to the title, it struck me. Wait a minute. The Book of Esther is the same. Nothing has changed. It's the same book. Yet, after the Holocaust, we read it differently than we did before. It's not in the book, it's in the mind of the reader. And this is true regarding everything, and a lot of hard feelings and high emotions in Adventism could be calmed down if people just realized, okay, I see what I see because of who I am. We see the world the way we are. And this idea that Jesus and I see it the same way, you know, the way I see it is exactly the same way as Jesus sees it, borders a little bit on blasphemy, you know. In John 10:35, the Pharisees say to Jesus, "You are a mere man, how come you claim to be God?" It's a blasphemy. So, here's the culprit. Here's the question for the delegates of 2015 General Conference session in San Antonio. So here's the question. After your prayerful study on ordination from the Bible, the writings of Ellen White, and the reports of the study commission, and after your careful consideration what is best for the church and the fulfillment of its mission, is it acceptable for division executive committees, as they may deem it appropriate in their territories, to make provision for the ordination of women to the gospel ministry? Yes or no? Even to correct a little bit what Bernie said, the division is not going to make the decision. The division is going to make the decision that yes, it's okay for the British Union Executive Committee to go ahead. We cannot make the decision for any field. We only can make the decision the Division Executive Committee that the unions that desire so in our territory can go ahead and do it. Now, I don't know if you have seen the clip where Mr. Bean takes an exam. Remember? The guy who sits on supervising the exam, and Mr. Bean tries all these tricks, you know, to copy from people around, and then finally at the end of the clip, the man says, "And those of you who have been answering the question on algebra, put it to one side, and those of you who have answered questions on trigonometry, put it to the other side." And then he starts frantically looking into the envelope, realizing that he was answering the wrong question all the way. Now, what I am afraid is that this is going to happen in San Antonio. That most delegates are going to be answering the wrong question. Because if you notice, the question is not, according to your reading of the Bible and Spirit of Prophecy, according to your understanding, does the Bible allow women to be ordained or not? That's not the question. Let me humbly suggest that after the TOSC, after the Theology of Ordination Study Committee, we cannot go back to that question. If you want to know biblical arguments, they are all on the internet. You can go on the web page or the website of GC Archives. All the papers are there. You can read the arguments from both sides. But they have realized for 2 years, reading papers, discussing it back and forth, is it a bit like the close of probation, you know? They realize that those who are on this side are not going to change their position and come to that side, and those who are on that side are not going to change their position and come to that side. You know, like Revelation 22:11. He who is clean, let him remain clean, and who is not, let him remain where he is. They realized we can't resolve this with exegetical arguments, with arguments from the Bible. And that's why the question says, do you trust, brothers and sisters, in Trans-European Division Executive Committee, that they will make a good decision for their territory? And for the delegates of Trans-European Division, the question is, do you trust the delegates of South Africa Indian Ocean Division to make a good decision for their territory? And I am not so sure how many delegates are going to understand this. Because what I am afraid is, back to the clip on trigonometry and algebra and Mr. Bean, that many delegates are going to be answering the wrong question. But the question is not, in your understanding, does the Bible allow women to be ordained? And there is a good reason why we don't ask that question. What we ask is the question of trust. And then, of course, I will come back to that once I can, and I explain to you the basic dynamics of this debate. What are the implications if the answer is no? We don't trust one another in the body of Christ. Do you realize what we just said? What's the danger of what we vote? What will be the outcome if we say we don't trust one another? Anyway, so the ordination of women into gospel ministry, it's a hermeneutical question. Hermeneutics is a science of interpretation. Hermeneutical question means, what are we supposed to do in 2015 in Scotland? How do you interpret the Bible so that it answers the question, what am I supposed to do in my life here and now? Probably some of you have heard me saying that this typical question of Sabbath school, what is Jeremiah saying to us, is a wrong question to ask, because the answer is quick and simple, nothing. You know, Jeremiah had no idea that you are going to study his book the fourth quarter of this year for Sabbath school lessons. He's not trying to say anything to you. Now, if you ask the question, what is Jeremiah trying to say to his audience? That's a good and legitimate question. And once you understand that, You can make an application for your life, but this is the process that we call hermeneutics. So it's good and useful to read the book of Jeremiah because it's inspired. But if you start with the wrong question, what is Jeremiah saying to me? You know, the probability that you end up with the wrong answer is very high. It's like the question, Daniel, have you stopped your wife? Have you stopped beating your wife yet? Whatever you answer, you are in trouble. You start with the wrong question, you know, and you end up with the wrong answer. So it's a question of hermeneutics. It's a question of exegesis. How do you understand some texts of the Bible? So when Paul says that the elder needs to be a husband of one wife, do you know how Catholics understand that text? Because they've got a problem too, you know. If you believe that that the priest should be celibate, and the text says that, no, he should be a husband of one wife, you are in trouble. But they say, no. The woman means a church, and husband of one wife means committed to the church. Is that a good exegesis? Is that a good understanding of what Paul was trying to say? So it's an exegetical question. Besides that, it's a historical question. In 1881 was the first time this question came to the General Conference Executive Committee. It's nothing new under the sun, even in Adventism. And of course, the other church communities dealt with this issue before. Then it's a sociological problem. I wanted to say to the dear brother yesterday when he said, but the Bible is clear. We should not do what the culture says. The Bible is clear. I felt like saying, okay, so how is it that I can almost predict, based on where you come from, what will be the outcome, what you see? So if you come from Silicon Valley, from San Francisco, you are going to see one thing. If you come from Philippines, you are most probably going to see something else. Why? Because your sociology, the group where you come from, determines what you see. Back to Talmud, remember? We don't see the world the way it is. We see the world the way we are. And as Bernie mentioned in the introduction, this is becoming a very emotional issue. Even to the extent that people say, if the vote goes this way, then I'm not going to pay the tithe, you know, I'm not going to come to church anymore, etc. So it's becoming a very emotional, psychological issue for people. And sure, of course, it's a theological issue. In other words, there is a system of thinking behind it. And what is that system of beliefs? Recently, there has been a strong push for the headship theology, to argue from the headship theology, you know, that God is the head of Christ and Christ is the head of the church and the males are the head of females, etc. The problem is that the headship theology comes from Calvinistic background, from Calvinistic mindset. It's incompatible with Adventism. Yet most people can't see it. But no, you can't go this way, you know. If you remember when we discussed 1844, I told you that as a young pastor, I have heard a top church administrator saying, I agree with Desmond Ford on justification, I just don't agree with him on the sanctuary doctrine. And even as a young pastor, I said, okay, the reason why you say so is because you are a church administrator. If you were a theologian, you would understand that if you agree with him on righteousness by faith, it's only a question of time, you will have to agree with him on the sanctuary. Just think the thoughts to their natural conclusion. Because if you are neo-Lutheran in justification, if justification is something that happens at God's throne, then you don't need investigative judgment. There is no sanctuary doctrine as Adventists understand it. So you think in systems, you think in methods of interpretation, in models of interpretation. Have you followed this week the news from Geneva, from the laboratory, CERN? You know, the huge collideron, and the scientist saying, if this is true, then we need to deal with models of interpretation, because you can't think otherwise, only in models of interpretation. And so once you accept one model, it has far-reaching consequences. All right, so here is the thing, what we are going to do. before we go, what happens after San Antonio? And let me tell you, this morning and afternoon, I talk to you as one of you. I have been the head elder of the New Bold Church for 5 years. Before I went to the division, I was the head elder of New Bold Church. And I am a pastor at heart. And I suspect that by the time we are finished, you will know where I stand on the issue. But that's irrelevant. What Daniel Duda thinks doesn't matter. But before we say, guys, this is at the core a pastoral care issue, I need to explain to you how the groups think. Because if I say to you, this is a pastoral care issue, what are we going to do, you and I, after 12th of July, the Sunday 12th of July, when the GC session is finished, and a significant number of people are going to be bitterly disappointed because they prayed, they hoped, and God did not deliver. What are we going to do as the ones who have the duty of care, and duty of care not only for those who believe as I do, as we do, but the duty of care for the whole flock, for everybody? What are we going to do with it, about it? But if I start with that, I get a significant response of people saying, no, this is the truth, this is how it is. When we had the meeting at BUC, Karen was there at the registration, and she said to me, she heard two people going out, you know, I came here ready to fight, and there was no chance. Frustrated. You know, I was here ready to fight, and we talked about pastoral care. But there is a reason why we need to do that. But for that, you need to understand, how is it possible that people read the same Bible yet come to two completely opposing different conclusions? How is it possible that you read the same Bible and come to a different conclusion? So regardless where you stand on the issue, I am not going to ask you what you think about it. I am not going to ask you what is the truth. I am not even going to ask you what is it that Paul says. I am going to ask you, do you understand how someone reading that Bible can come to this conclusion? Can you follow the process how they come to this conclusion? I used to teach a class, Biblical Theology of Church Ministry and Mission, with Steve Carroll, which was a compulsory class that every MA student at New Bold had to take, regardless whether they took MA in Old Testament or New Testament or systematic theology or pastoral studies. Everybody had to take that class, Biblical Theology of Church Ministry and Mission. And the students were expected to write a paper, and very often the first week of the classes, the student eagerly said, oh, professor, I want to write a paper on women's ordination. And we would say to him, we would prefer if you don't. It is a position paper. You know, you want to preach to us how we are supposed to see it. And if we don't, there is something terribly wrong with this wicked professor who doesn't see the truth as I see it. You want to write a position paper. We want you to write a process paper. How did you come to that conclusion? And if you have strong emotions, strong feelings about something, most probably you are not aware of the process that led to that conclusion. So, here is the thinking behind the two camps. Okay, this is how people come to their conclusion. The opponents of women's ordination start with a clear reading of the Bible. This is what you need to understand. How is it that someone says, no, this is a terrible, disastrous deviation that needs to be fought, that needs to be opposed? This idea that women can be ordained pastors, this comes from, you know, and strong arguments are used, you know, the demonic teaching, etc. Why? Because the Bible is plain. As Australian evangelist would say, the truth is as plain as the nose in your face. You need to understand that most pioneers who spread Adventism in our countries did not have any theological training, did not have degrees in theology, special exegetical skills. And so, when they read the Bible and they came to preach the message, they said, "So, sir, can you open your Bible to Exodus 20, verse 8? What does it say? Read it. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy." "Yes, but," they said, "our priest says..." No, not what the priest says. Read it again. What does the Bible say? "Yeah, but historically, the Christian church for..." No, not what the history. What the text says. So whether it was the Sabbath, or clean and unclean food, whether it was the food washing, or tithing, or 24-hour creation, they all got it from plain reading of the Bible. Now, at this stage, let me say this. When Ellen G. White died in July 1915, we'll have in a few weeks, 100 years since her death, her world was not that different from the world of Martin Luther, who died 1563, in 16th century. And the world of Martin Luther, who died in 16th century, was not that different from the world of Jesus Christ, who lived in 1st century AD. And the world of Jesus Christ was not that different from the world of Abraham, who lived 2,000 years before Jesus. But something has happened in the last 50 years or so. The way how people think has changed. Anyone who has a GCSE's level of education nowadays has had training in critical thinking. 50 years ago, whatever the teacher, whatever the professor, whatever the priest, whatever the boss at work said, that was the truth. That's what you obey. That's how the reality is. But now, people think differently. But you can understand that when the pioneers came and first preached the message, which is so dear and special to us, they did it by appealing to the plain reading of the Bible. And as I said, this is based on the Scottish common sense philosophy that originated from this part of the world. As a response to terrible liberalism of 18th century, which shook the foundations of the Christian world. Enlightenment said, "We are not going to accept something just because the priest, the Pope, or the Bible said so. We are only going to believe things which are rational, which are logical." How do you deal with that? So William Miller believes that if you take the King James Version of the Bible and read all the texts, if with a good concordance you find all the texts and read them, you will see the truth. Don't worry about Greek, don't worry about Hebrew, you don't need that. Don't need theological education. Why would you bother? Just read the Bible and you will get the meaning. Why? Plain reading of the Bible. Our entire belief structure, our entire reason for existence, our mission to the world, all are based on the authority of the Bible. And so, the clear way, the plain way of reading the Bible is the way to understand it. So, that's the first point. Do you understand that? How come that some people come opposing this dangerous novelty? Well, because you are supposed to read the Bible with the plain reading. Secondly, you start reading the Bible from 1 Timothy 2, 9-12. Okay? Because 1 Timothy 2:12 is a plain text. It's a clear text. Basically, there are six key passages in the New Testament which are crucial for both sides of the debate. And if you are the opponent of this, you start from 1 Timothy 2:12. And the 1 Timothy 2:12 says, "I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man. She must be silent." And of course, if you subscribe to the plain reading of the Bible, the question is, which part of the text you don't understand? Which part of the text is not clear to you? And the argument is, you don't need any theological training, you don't need any degrees, you just read the text wherever you are, which part of whichever part of the world, and the meaning is clear. It's plain. And of course, then, the 1 Timothy 3, it says that the bishop or elder or overseer, depending how you translate the episkopos, must be husband of one wife. And of course, the argument is, if it's the husband of one wife, then it cannot be the wife of one husband. And so this clearly presupposes that Paul says that the elder, the bishop, the overseer, must be a male. By the way, I hope you realize that in the 19th century discussions in America about the slavery, the argument was that if Paul says, and you slaves submit to your masters, the argument went, if Paul speaks about the slavery, that means the slavery is going to stay until the second coming. Okay? And now we look at it and laugh and say, they were children of their own time. Yeah, that's why they saw it this way. 1 Corinthians 14, women should remain silent in the churches. They are not allowed to speak, must be in submission, as the law says. If they want to inquire about something, they should ask their own husbands at home, for it is disgraceful for a woman to speak in the church. So here's the second point. You start from 1 Timothy 2:12, because it's a plain text. It's a clear text. And you interpret all the text in light of that one. First point, plain reading of the Bible is the way to go. Second point, you start from the most plain text you can find on the issue, 1 Timothy 2:12. And you interpret everything else in light of that text. Okay? Thirdly, when Paul says this to Timothy, which is an instruction for one church in Ephesus, and then 1 Corinthians 14, the one that they should be silent, it is not only the instruction for one church in that local congregation. Because he's inspired, it's instruction for all Christian churches through all the ages until Jesus comes. There is no reason why that should change. And because Paul said that to Timothy, and because he's inspired, it's true for everybody else until Jesus comes. Now, the next thing is important to say. Sometimes the opponents of women's ordination are accused of being against women in ministry. And they are going to say, no, we are not against women in church service or in ministry. We are just against them being ordained into the gospel ministry. So they have no problem if they serve as deaconesses, you know, if they serve as professors of theology, actually. But they should not be the gospel ministers, ordained ministers with a jurisdiction over the whole world. And the argument is, the Bible presents women as full participants with men in the religious and social life of the church. Although women served in the Old Testament temple, but they were not priests. They labored side by side with Apostle Paul, but they were not apostles. They were not chosen as apostles by Jesus or into prominent leadership positions in the early church. This should indicate to us that this is how things ought to stay until the second coming of Jesus. Though you had women priests in the surrounding nations of Israel, but no women priests in Israel, no women disciples in the Gospels, that's the indication to you how it's supposed to stay until Jesus comes. Once again, I'm not asking if this is true. If you know any argument against this, I'm asking, do you understand that this is a closed system? Once you start with a plain reading of the Bible, every step logically follows and you can't escape the conclusion. And here comes the thing. Therefore, the hierarchical model that males should be about females is seen as a part of creation. So you start from 1 Timothy 2, and then you ask the question, so why is it so? Where did this come from? And then you read it back into the Genesis. And you say, you see, it's already there in Genesis 3, where Eve is subject to her husband, and he will rule over you, Genesis 3:16. And because it's a part of creation, Bakioki, let his soul rest in peace, will say, there's nothing we can do about it. This is part of the creation order. This is how God intended things to be. It must be seen as something which is important, and if we want the doctrine of Sabbath to stand and the doctrine of creation to be true, which is so important to us as Seventh-day Adventists, then we must accept the hierarchical structure of ministry as well. And this step introduces you to so-called domino effect, which is an important aspect of the thinking of the opponents. They see the ordination of women as something which is dangerous for the church, not because of what happens with the ordination of women, but because of what it starts. I will come to that later. They see that this is going to be, you know, a slippery slope, beginning of terrible things which are going to come to the church if we start on this journey. Okay, they also read the Bible and they are aware of the text in Galatians 3:28, which says, in Christ there is no Greek or Gentile, slave or free, male or female, but their response is, this deals with religious status, with access to salvation. This does not deal with distinctions in roles between male and female, between men and women. Therefore, there is no role interchangeability implied here. Both men and women have equal worth, equal access to salvation, but they don't have equal functions in the church. So this would be their answer to Galatians 3:28. Once again, I am not asking you if you agree with this reasoning, this line of argument. I am asking you, do you understand that people who think this way end up opposing women's ordination? That's the question. Do you understand the system, the thinking behind, that it's a closed system? Once you start with that presupposition, there is no way avoiding the conclusion. And the conclusion is, and therefore, women should not be ordained into gospel ministry. So, here is the summary. Because the Bible was written for everyone, we must take it the way it reads. The plain reading of the Bible is the way to go. And the presupposition is the Bible is clear on ordination. By the way, I thought I brought the book with me. I just checked and it stayed on my desk at the division. There is a short summary of the 700 plus pages document that the TED executive committee approved on this issue, because each division was asked to present the paper on how they see the issue on their territory, and you have the both exegetical, both biblical arguments and historical. This is precious historical material showing how the ordination of
of the scribes, you know, because you deal with sacred texts, and so in order to be the copyist of the Bible, you have to be ordained in Second Temple Judaism, and then how the ordination was important in the Roman structures because you pass on the political authority. So it's pressure material, very precious material. The problem is that nowadays people don't read 700 plus pages. So the executive committee in November asked the division to prepare a layman's popular version, about 100 pages. And the book was recently published and is available from Stumborough Press by Tom De Bruin. And I intended to show you the one copy that I have for you to see it. And Tom De Bruin just succinctly, in a very nice way, in a very easy and readable way, presents this. And this was exactly what I heard yesterday from the two guys in the Edinburgh church, who said, but the Bible is very clear on ordination. Huh? Really? And the book will nicely go through the whole biblical material, and when it speaks about the ordination of Joshua, you know, we'll tell you, and these are the reasons why this cannot be applied to the ordination of women debate, because, you know, it was one-off, it was never repeated, etc. So as it goes through the biblical material, every time, you know, it will give you reasons why this can or cannot be considered. So it's a very nice and good book. I recommend you to read it. So the idea here is the plain reading of the Bible is the way to go. And because the Bible is clear on ordination, our authority is the Bible, not the culture. There is going to be, if we follow the culture, there is going to be the domino effect. A former Lutheran pastor, Ray Holmes, says if we ordain women, ordination of gay men is going to be the next step. But that does not mean that opponents of women's ordination are against the work of women in the church and in ministry, because you need to distinguish between spiritual gifts. Everybody has got the gift, but not everybody has an office. And so the offices are reserved for males, while the gifts are for everybody. And because ordination is gender specific in the Bible, so it's always the males who are ordained, 70 elders, Joshua, you know, the apostles, the seven deacons, although the Bible doesn't call them deacons, but because ordination in the Bible is always for males only, it needs to stay that way. All right, so this is the argument of the opponents of women's ordination. Once again, let me remind you, I am not asking, do you agree with this? I am not asking, is this your position? Does it appeal to you? If it does, okay. I am asking, do you understand the arguing behind? Do you understand how someone can read the Bible and come to the conclusion, no, this is a dangerous, bad thing, let's not even start going in that direction? In New York, you have this announcements: don't even think of parking here. You know, so, do you understand why someone comes to the conclusion, don't even think of parking here? Don't even think of going in that direction. If we are the church that has the high view of Scripture, that takes the Bible seriously, do you understand this? I'm not asking, do you agree with that? I'm asking, do you see how someone can come to this conclusion? Some years ago, when I was still in Czechoslovakia, I was at the meeting of evangelicals where John Stott came and had some presentations, and this was shortly after he announced that he does not believe in the everlasting burning hell anymore. And you can imagine this created quite a stir in evangelical circles, because here was the icon of evangelical theology, John Stott, and he decided that he doesn't believe in the immortal soul and the everlasting burning hell. And so there were some Baptists who really went after him and tried to attack him. How can you do that? And you know, he just
gently looked at them with his stately wisdom, and he said, "You know, if you believe in immortal soul and everlasting burning hell, there are some difficult questions, difficult texts in the Bible you have to deal with. And if you don't believe in immortal soul and everlasting burning hell, there are some difficult texts in the Bible you have to deal with. So here are some difficult questions that you have to deal with if you believe that women should not be ordained. So I think I have three questions for each group, and then I will give you the break. As I told you, opponents start with 1 Timothy 2:12, because it's a plain text. Here's the question. If we did not start with 1 Timothy 2:12, but we started elsewhere in the Bible, would we come to the same conclusion? If you have ever met Jehovah's Witness, and they read to you the text, Revelation 3:14, this is what Amen, the true and faithful witness, says, the beginning of creation of God. And they say, you see, Jesus is the created being. Here it clearly says the beginning of creation of God. So Jesus is the first created being. You say to them, wait a minute, beginning of the creation of God does not necessarily mean a passive beginning, that he is the first created being. It can mean the active beginning of the creation of God, that all creation has its beginning in him. We say to them, you can't start with a text which can be interpreted this way or that way, and then twist all the other texts in the Bible in light of that text. This is not good hermeneutics. This is not good approach. Analogically, we say, oh, wait a minute. If we did not start with 1 Timothy 2:12, if we started elsewhere, would we arrive at the same conclusion? Is it possible that the conclusion you arrive at is determined by your starting point? So there is no question that the text in 1 Timothy 2:12 is very plain, very clear, and that Paul expects the church in Ephesus, you know, to follow that. But if we started not in 1 Timothy or in Titus, would we end up in a different point? It's a difficult question. A second question. When Paul says women should be silent, when Paul says that the bishop or the episcopos, the elder, whichever way you translate, should be the husband of one wife, he is not discussing the ordination issue. He is not answering the question, so who can be ordained? No. He's discussing the qualifications for the office. Or in other words, there is a problem in the church of Ephesus. If you compare 1 Corinthians 12 and 14, where the spiritual gifts are operational, with 1 Timothy or Titus, you can see that you have a church where that has a problem. That everybody wants to speak. Remember 1 Corinthians, Paul says, all of you want to speak in tongues because you are immature. You think that if you are on the platform, you are more important than those who just sit. And that's why Paul says, let's do it this way. Timothy is going to determine who can speak from the pulpit, who is allowed to preach to the congregation. But he's not discussing the ordination issue. Is it fair to argue the plain reading of the scripture if nobody in the church follows the plain reading of the scripture? In other words, yes, Paul says that the episcopos should be husband of one wife, but we still ordain a single man. Not very often, because in today's society most people get married, but probably you and I can name a few people who have been ordained who are single. So we did not follow as an Adventist church husband of one wife because we ordained a single man. We ordained married men with no children.
Paul says that his children, plural, must be in truth. Yet, if you are married and you have no children, we still ordain you. I think, Marcel, when we ordained you, you had no children. Or did you have Josh already? No, you see, we ordained Marcel in Scotland with no children, against plain reading of the Bible. We ordain married men with one child. All the text clearly says that children must be in the truth. And of course, if the children are over 18 and not in the truth, we still ordain them because we say, okay, they are adults, they make their own choices. You know, so why should we not ordain the pastor if he's doing a good job and we have a clear evidence that the Holy Spirit is using him, in spite of the fact that the children chose their own direction in life. So we as Adventists never understood husband of one wife in the plain literal meaning. And because the discussion is not about ordination anyway, is it fair to use it as an argument for ordination issue? Now, if you look into any good commentary, it will tell you that there are 8 different interpretations of this phrase, husband of one wife. So throughout the centuries, people came to 8 different understanding of what husband of one wife is supposed to mean. I gave you the Catholic understanding, which says that the priest should be committed to the church. That is one of the interpretations. So if there are 8 different interpretations of that, is the plain way of reading the best way to go in 21st century? Or are we in danger of missing the point the author wanted to make? And are just importing our own agenda into the text? What is plain to you, but not necessarily plain to Apostle Paul? And the last question, is the plain reading of the Bible the way to read it in the 21st century? When you say, I just accepted the way it reads, it never reads. You read. Remember the microscope and the leaf under the microscope? What you see there is not what it reads. It's what's in your presuppositions. So, when you claim the way I read it is the way St. Paul intended, is that a responsible way of reading the Bible? Or are you fusing the two horizons? That your horizon, your perspective, suddenly becomes the perspective of St. Paul. Now remember, he's inspired, not you, not me. And therefore, we need to keep the two horizons apart. This is what Paul says, and this is how we understand it. But my understanding is not the understanding of St. Paul. He is the apostle. I am a servant. So we cannot fuse the horizon of the 21st century reader with the horizon of the first century writer. Is it possible that if we had another model of interpreting, and I will explain to that to you after the break, that we would come to a different conclusion? All right, so here are the 3 difficult questions to ask to the opponents of women's ordination, because it's a closed system. If you start on that presupposition, you come to that conclusion. But with every model, there is always a few difficult texts to deal with, or a few difficult questions to answer if you choose to go that way. All right, so let's have a break and see you 11:45.